G'day, folks, and welcome. I'm Chris Faber.
And I'm TJ Steadman.
And you're listening to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, coming to you from sunny Western Australia. G'day, folks, and welcome back to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, the show that tackles your questions about the biblical giants. Over the last 2 weeks, we took a deep dive into the story of the rebellion of Korah. We saw how that was influential in our understanding of the flood story. And the week before that, we did the same thing, looking at the Exodus.
Yeah, we did. And hopefully that helped to illustrate the interpretive frame that the ancient Israelites would have brought to the flood story. So there are two main things going on here. A kind of Exodus where God's faithful people are being delivered from oppressive powers, and a judgment, not on human beings, but against the gods and the giants.
Right. So what are we doing this week?
I thought we'd start this week with more of an exploration of what was going on in this flood event that we've been talking about. And we're going to do that by getting into the text of Genesis 7 from verses 17 to 20. We've talked about some of this stuff before, but there's still plenty of interesting material in these verses that I want to talk about. And it's going to be important for getting an understanding of what the biblical author intended and what his audience understood regarding the nature of the flood itself. So I'll just read the text here from the King James Version and then get into it. This is Genesis 7, verses 17 to 20. And the flood was 40 days upon the earth, and the waters increased and bare up the ark, and it was lift up above the earth. And the waters prevailed, and were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went upon the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered.
Wait a minute, Tim. You didn't tell me that the flood was made out of soda.
What are you talking about?
You know, soda, Coke, pop, fizzy drink, whatever they call it.
You've lost me.
You said the waters increased and it was lift above the earth, so the flood turned into lemonade?
Oh, come on.
Well, it just sounds weird, but I guess when life gives you giants...
Yeah, make lemonade. Is that where you're going with this? When life gives you giants, you make lemonade?
Never mind. It sounded better in my head.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's really weird what Americans say when they're referring to carbonated beverages. Depending on where you go in the States, they're going to call it different things. In a lot of places in the South, they just call it Coke. So they'll ask you for a Coke, and then when you ask what flavor, they'll say Sprite or Dr. Pepper or whatever. You're a bit of a Dr. Pepper fan, aren't you?
I have been known to partake of the lovely stuff.
Oh, I can't stand it myself. But there's a lot of American drinks I really can't get the hang of. I don't get this American fascination with cherry-flavored stuff. And don't start me on root beer and sarsaparilla and that kind of thing. But when I think about how many Americans gag when they think about drinking eggnog in summer, I guess we've all got our quirks. Actually, I like what the NIV does with this because they have the phrase, they lifted the ark in that spot, which means that they're recognizing the plurality and the agency of the waters and not just attributing the movement to the ark itself. And that's really important.
Okay, so tell us a bit more about the forces that are at work here at this point in the story then.
All right, so we've got this 40-day period in which the divine beings represented here by the word flood in English, that's mabul in Hebrew, are active in the land. And for those who came in late and are wondering what I'm talking about here, just a reminder that this particular word occurs about a dozen times in the flood story itself and in that immediate context within the primeval history. And then there's only one other occasion in the whole Bible where we find this word, and it's in Psalm 29, verse 10. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a rough translation of that in the way that I believe it's supposed to be understood. This is Psalm 29, and what I'm going to do here is give you an adaptation of the psalm with particular attention to interpreting the symbolic language being used here. Okay, so I'm going to kind of smooth this out a bit for modern readers. So this is Psalm 29 from verse 1, a psalm of David. Ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Give the Lord the glory due his name. Worship the Lord in holy array. The thunder of the Lord is upon the spirits. The God of glory thunders. The Lord is over many spirits. The thunder of the Lord is powerful. The thunder of the Lord is full of majesty. The thunder of the Lord breaks the cedars. Yes, the Lord breaks the gods of Lebanon. He makes them also to skip like a calf. Lebanon and Sirion, like a young ox. The thunder of the Lord divides the flames of divine fire. The thunder of the Lord shakes the wilderness. The Lord shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. The thunder of the Lord twists the oaks and strips the forests, and in his temple everyone speaks of his glory. The Lord sits in judgment upon the divine procession. Yes, the Lord is enthroned as king forever. May the Lord give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people with peace. All right, so that's my paraphrase based loosely on both the King James and the RSV.
Okay, so is that a different kind of reading than what most people are going to have in their Bible?
Yeah, what none of these translations are going to show you is that the word which is translated as flood in verse 10 is that word mabul, which appears only in the Genesis flood story and nowhere else except here. I chose to render it as divine procession because I believe that it's the most fitting way to describe what's being portrayed here in this psalm. I did a couple of other things in this reading to make it a little clearer. In particular, where your translation might have the voice of the Lord, I went with my preferred term there, which is thunder. And again, I've touched on that in previous episodes if you want to know why I did that. And I also used the word gods in verse 5, where you'll see the word for cedars. And probably the most obvious thing that I did here as an interpretive choice was replacing the word waters with spirits, which, like the other changes I made, is obviously not a translation, but an interpretation of that symbolic language. So my intent here is not to change the meaning, but to give us words in English that make the meaning more apparent.
You don't want to go with something more descriptive of those spirits? Like you don't want to say whether they're good, bad, chaotic or whatever?
No, I don't think we're given any indication as to the inclination of those divine beings. And ultimately, they are under the sovereignty of God. So they have to do what he wants them to do, regardless of how they feel about it. But given that we're not told, I decided to refrain from putting any spin on it. I could have perhaps gone further and explained Lebanon as the mountain of the gods or something like that, but you can just get really carried away here and you end up losing the feeling of the whole thing. But the whole point of this exercise was basically to illustrate that Psalm 29 has a divine council setting, and that should provide the interpretive framework that helps us to understand that word, which is translated as flood, in every other place where we find it. Because as we've been learning over the last few months on the podcast, that understanding where we can read that as a divine procession works in every situation in which we find it. Again, I'm not suggesting that choosing the word flood to translate mabul was a bad choice, because that definitely works on a surface level reading of the text and it provides the necessary symbolic imagery. But our problem is that without an understanding of what the symbol represents, it ceases to be a symbol and it gets taken literally. And that was really the point of giving you my rendering of Psalm 29. I wanted those symbols to be brought to life for our listeners. But I think anyone who's been following our podcast from the very beginning should have been able to pick up that psalm and get all those interpretive layers on their own anyway. So we've got that symbolic language of 40 days, which represents judgment and also preparation for what's to come. And during this time, the divine procession is acting upon the earth to carry out God's judgment. And I've been asked before as to what I think that actually looks like, which is where we have to come back to the original premise of the flood story as a means of illustrating what's happening here. And the illustration shows a deluge of water and an overwhelming storm.
So the thing you would have seen if you'd been standing there is exactly the kind of thing your kids have been drawing your Sunday school. Lots of water, no land in sight, and a big boat with Noah and his family and a whole bunch of animals on board.
Yeah, but what you don't get in the Sunday school flannel graph is the destruction and the warfare and the violence between the inhabitants of the earth as the waters of the flood close in around them.
So the waters lifted up the ark and it rose high above the earth. This goes back to what we were saying last time in our discussion of the sons of Korah and the idea that they were spared from death and from potentially a fate in the bad part of the underworld. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And this is why I said earlier that I liked what the NIV was doing with this idea of the waters lifting the ark. God has caused these divine beings to preserve Noah and his household from the violence and chaos below, literally carrying them above or beyond the openings to the underworld. In this text, the word Eretz or earth here is used in much the same way that Moses uses it in Exodus 15. It's the gateway to Hades or Sheol, if you like. And we find in later traditions that the number 8, as in the 8 survivors of the ark, comes to represent crossing over into something new or passing from one life into the next, from one world order into a new one.
So that's another one of those associations between the flood story and the idea of hope for the afterlife.
That's right. Moving on now, let's have a look at this idea of the waters prevailing.
That's an interesting choice of terminology.
It certainly is, because the idea being conveyed here is all about strength and power and being mighty. So that's not really the kind of language you'd use just for saying that the water got deeper or something. Some translations use the idea of the water surging to convey that kind of powerful movement. And I think that works quite well, because if you're a person faced with this overwhelming force represented here by these waters, then you understand that your chances of survival are negligible. I just think that it's worth pointing out here that there are plenty of words that could be used to convey the idea of movement. So it would seem to me that if the chosen terminology in the Hebrew doesn't convey movement, but rather strength, then that is yet another indicator that we're talking about creatures of great power here instead of the movement of water. Obviously, the language is doing double duty because, as I've been maintaining from the outset here, we are telling two stories at once. The other thing that I like about the translation of prevailing is that it gives the idea of military action, which is consistent with what I've been saying about this story from the beginning. And again, there's no conflict there with the Hebrew, which I think supports that quite well. We've got these divine beings at war with the giants on the land, and the battle is definitely going God's way. We've just got to make sure that we remember that this is being illustrated as a real flood of actual water rather than swords and arrows and that kind of thing.
Not gonna lie, kind of one of the whole Dungeons and Dragons kind of battle scene with soldiers and armor, giants, storm gods, water spirit, all of that.
Ditto. Would have been cool. I mean, there's still room to imagine it that way, though. But the reason it's got to work this way is because there's a real historical flood story behind this narrative. I understand that some people are still not quite clear on where I stand on the historicity of a flood of water being described in this text. There aren't really too many other ways I can say it. A long time ago, there was a big flood of real water. And a guy whose name wasn't actually Noah, because Hebrew hadn't been invented yet, built a boat and saved himself and his family and some animals.
Yeah, that's right. This Sumerian guy's name was Tug or something.
Yeah, that story became well known, so much so that when it came time for the Jewish authors of the Hebrew scriptures to describe what happened to the old gods of the ancient world, it seemed to make good sense to them to utilize that story as a kind of Trojan horse in which they could slip their messaging and theology to convey it to their children under cover of popular narrative. See what I did there? Give me a shout in the discussion group. So what I'm saying here is that both of these events occurred in real time. And whether they happened at the same time or not is debatable, but not really important. Scripture is about the teaching, not about the event. I think anybody who's been listening up to this point and still needs the flood to be a real historical event recorded in Genesis for historical purposes has probably been missing the point so far. Stories in the ancient world are told for teaching messages more important than historical narrative. Nobody questioned whether there had been a real flood in the past. That was just assumed as common knowledge. And they weren't mistaken. This wasn't a made-up story or some kind of fiction. But again, I can't say it enough. Whether or not water fell from the sky and flooded the land isn't the point, because that has no inherent value to teach you how to live as a follower of Yahweh.
Okay, so there really was a flood.
Yeah.
And there really was a divine rebellion.
Yeah.
And the story about the flood is being used to also tell the story about this divine rebellion.
Yeah.
And the two things may have coincided historically, but also they may not.
Right.
And I guess the danger of necessarily trying to link those two things to a specific point in history is that we don't know ancient history that well.
Exactly.
So if in the future we learn something else about ancient history that changes our timeline, we haven't derailed the message of the text.
Yes. Yes. Someone gets it. Thank you.
No. No need to thank me. I'm just reading the script. I don't know, really. I don't know. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Anyway, the language describing this onslaught of the waters just keeps getting more intense. And it's designed to give you that sense of being overwhelmed. Remember the Atrahasis epic and the way the flood was described as this overwhelming divine weapon. Because it doesn't just prevail, it increases. And it's not just a slight increase or a little bit more. It's multiplying and growing in ferocity and intensity. The waters become more and more bigger, stronger, overwhelmingly so. This is truly both awe-inspiring and deeply terrifying. You're supposed to get the impression that you would have just lost it completely if you saw this. As they say in the old King Jimmy, I retained no strength in my loins. You get what I mean here? This is so powerful. And I mentioned this not long ago. We often have this idea that Noah's Ark just bobbed about on top of the water peacefully like a champagne cork in a pond. I don't think so. If we suspend disbelief for a moment, we take the story on face value. There is absolutely no way that a vessel like Noah's Ark could have sustained the stresses of this kind of deluge. And again, you can forget your Kentucky Ark encounter rubbish and go back to real historical boat building from the period, and that should be obvious. And then if we consider the damage being done to it from the outside, people trying to survive in spite of what was coming for them, wouldn't they have torn it apart? I mean, the practicalities don't work here.
Yeah, that's before we start talking about whether or not it really floated for a whole year.
Good point. The reason we spent so much time talking about narrow escapes from death over the last few episodes was to drive home the point that this was no cakewalk for the inhabitants of the Ark. This would have been a desperately harrowing ordeal. Now, that Russell Crowe movie about the flood, which was just called Noah, copped a lot of flack for depicting Noah as a violent alcoholic. I don't know how he coped with something like the kind of ordeal that he went through, but I think he handled it pretty well. I can't imagine coming out of something like that with my sanity intact. So it doesn't surprise me to learn about what Noah went through after the flood, but we'll talk more about that later. Getting back to the text, and the ark went upon the face of the waters. It just went. I like that. It just went. It's moving around, but there's no direction. There's no propulsion. There's no progress. There's no control. Noah and his family are just in for the ride, getting chucked about all over the place while this battle rages on beneath them. And I've probably mentioned before that there's no mention of a rudder on this boat. That's intentional. God is steering this ship. And the centrality of the biblical God is really coming to the fore here in the language of the story, because now we turn our attention to the mountains, and mountains are always connected to the abode of the gods, sometimes even standing in as literary representatives for the gods themselves. We saw that earlier in Psalm 29. So we shouldn't be surprised to find particular mention of the mountains here, not because it gives us any idea how deep the waters of the flood were, but because the function of the story is to show the supremacy of the biblical God. And therefore, the waters by necessity must cover these mountains and not only diminish them, but drown them, buried into obscurity. There's a good Aussie death metal reference for you. To overwhelm them as easily as the puny humans on the plains below. And again, the literalists will jump up and down about the global flood and insist that if the water is deep enough to cover mountains of some 9,000 meters above sea level, then it has to be a global flood. It just has to be. You can't have water that deep in one spot. It's got to cover the whole globe. Disc. Globe, whatever. If I haven't already given you enough reasons to understand that the point of this story is about Yahweh's defeat of the gods, then there probably isn't much point in trying to explain to you the use of this imagery here.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you joined us recently and you're feeling like you're a bit out of your depth, hit my pay to go back to the earlier seasons of the podcast and trying to catch up with stuff that we've already covered.
I see what you did there. And there are plenty of other people missing the point here, even if they subscribe to a local or regional flood model, because you've got plenty of commentators arguing, and they're not wrong, that you could apply the same language to hills, and they don't necessarily have to be that big to be described in the same terminology. The Hebrew word's the same there. The height of the hills isn't the point. Whether you call them mountains or hills isn't the point. It's what they represent that matters. And this might be the first time in the primeval history that we've made mention of mountains or hills, since that wasn't made explicit in the Garden of Eden story. But that doesn't diminish the point that people already had a well-established understanding that high places were directly connected to the gods that were worshipped there. So if the covering of the mountains isn't about the depth of the water, it's about the drowning of the gods. It's about their defeat at the hands of Yahweh. It's about the way that they were cut down in this cosmic battle and defeated easily, relegated to the depths of the underworld forever. And there's an intentional juxtaposition in play in verse 19, where the earth and the mountains are both under heaven and both covered by the prevailing waters. The cosmological order is being reinstated here, and the mountains are being equivocated with the underworld. The mountains are no longer high places because the gods have been brought down beneath them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, but I do have a question, though. What's the deal with specifically mentioning 15 cubits? Is that a symbolic number or something? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a good question. Naturally, it's there for a reason. So what we need to think about here is, what would an ancient person have associated with a height of 15 cubits?
I do not know. Remind me again what a cubit is.
Sure. For people unfamiliar, a cubit is a unit of measure for measuring length or height or whatever. And in the ancient Near East, the standard cubit was roughly 18 inches in freedom units or 45 centimeters in the globally accepted metric standard. So that's 6.75 meters of depth above the height of the mountains, or 22.5 eagle screams.
Freedom! So the giants in the Bible aren't that big, are they?
No, they're not, and that's really the point. Even the gods themselves are not said to be that tall. Even Asterius in the Greek literature, who was the father of Anax, from whom we get the Anakim, he was only 10 cubits in height. Only 10 cubits. He's a 15-footer, right? More than double the height of Shaquille O'Neal. And Asterius, if he were there, would still find himself easily 6 feet under. And Gilgamesh, if we want to look at the Mesopotamian giants, he was something like 16 feet tall. So again, he's not going to make it out alive. It's not about taking the stuff literally, though. You're supposed to just be getting the idea that none of the gods or the giants that they fathered had any chance of surviving this judgment.
That's pretty cool. Well, that brings us to the end of our reading for this week.
Sure does.
What have we got for next time?
I can't decide, although I think it's going to be a choice between tea and cake or death.
Tea and cake or death? What sort of choice is that?
You'll have to ask Eddie Izzard. Somehow I think we're going to be all out of tea and or cake.
So it's or death then. That's not much of a choice.
You could have the chicken, I suppose.
Fair enough. Well, let's do some Q&A.
I want to hear your giant questions. If you have a question about stuff you've heard on the show or somewhere else, something you found in your Bible, or just some general feedback you'd like to tell us and the world at large, here's how you do it. Head to the website, giantanswers.com. I personally receive all your mail, and I will try to get to all of it. I love hearing from you, especially if I can help you get answers to your giant questions.
Greg asked via the website, giantanswers.com, was the transfiguration actually a glimpse into the future? Could the disciples have actually been transported to the time of the second coming? Would that explain when Jesus told them that some of them would not die until they saw him coming, Matthew 16:28? Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. A little pet theory of mine. Love the show! All caps.
Well, thanks very much, Greg. All caps. That's lovely of you to say, and I really like your question. Thanks for sending it in. This is going to be fun. Let's start with a little bit of background and talk about the transfiguration in broad terms as it appears in the Gospels. According to Matthew in chapter 16, we have events in this order. The Pharisees come and test Jesus, which he responds to with reference to the sign of Jonah. Then the disciples and Jesus go across the lake. Then we have Peter's confession of Christ at Caesarea Philippi. That's Matthew 16, verse 13. And after that, Jesus foretells his death and rebukes Peter, who obviously didn't want that to happen.
That's right. And then Jesus goes on to talk about the cost of discipleship, and he ends his discourse with a verse that Greg has mentioned at the end of chapter 16. Truly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom.
Yeah, then we move on to chapter 17 and the transfiguration. And of course, we have to remember that originally these things were not written with chapter and verse breaks and all that kind of thing. So this is a continuation of the narrative which follows from Peter's confession at Caesarea Philippi. So they're on this high mountain, which is probably Mount Hermon, because Caesarea Philippi is located at the base of that mountain range. And the event of the transfiguration occurs here. The Synoptic Gospels also record this event in much the same fashion, although Luke includes different events occurring either side of the Transfiguration event and also includes extra detail in the Transfiguration story. And if you've been following the podcast lately, you'll know that we spent a lot of time talking about the sons of Korah and the traditions that arose around them. And we made the connection that Elijah the prophet was probably a Korahite too. So it should be no surprise to us that in the context of this amazing event of the Transfiguration, we have discussions about Elijah in the lead up to that event. And lo and behold, there he is, not only appearing with Jesus, but also with Moses. So we've got three guys here, one of which could raise people from the dead by the power of God, one who died and was buried secretly by God. And then, of course, there's Jesus, who within about a fortnight of this event is going to be both crucified and raised from the dead himself. So all of these men had interesting mountaintop experiences with God in person while they lived. All of them had unusual circumstances surrounding the end of their mortal lives on earth. Just to recap, I'll give you the passage from Deuteronomy chapter 34, when Moses dies and is buried. So it's Deuteronomy 34, verses 5 to 8. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor. But no man knows the place of his burial to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was not dim, nor was his natural force abated. And the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended.
And last week we had that part from 2 Kings chapter 2, where Elijah goes up to heaven. 2 Kings 2, 11 to 12. And as they still went on and talked, behold, a chariot of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And he saw him no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and rent them in two pieces.
All right, so it's pretty clear that these two guys no longer exist in their old embodied state as their friends and family would have experienced them. And as we've been talking about recently on the show, it's clear that Jewish eschatological hope centered around a glorious afterlife for those who were faithful to Yahweh. Naturally, that makes us think that what we're seeing here is a kind of preview of the resurrection. And here we have all three of these individuals appearing in glory. Before we get too carried away, though, with trying to explain what's going on there, I have another passage of scripture that I just want to throw into the mix. And here we have Jesus saying a very similar thing in a slightly different context. So this is Matthew 26, verses 62 to 64. And the high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus was silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "You have said so. But I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven."
Well, that's interesting. That sounds very much like what we were reading earlier.
Yeah, so the reason I bring this one up is because we've got something very similar to what Jesus said earlier to his disciples in the lead up to the transfiguration. And this time it is at his trial prior to his execution, and that occurs after the transfiguration event. So in response to a part of Greg's question where he was asking if the transfiguration event would explain why Jesus had said this earlier, Greg isn't wrong, but that's not the whole answer, because this is much bigger than the transfiguration, and it really concerns the resurrection, which inaugurates the reign of Christ as king among those faithful to him. So this saying of Jesus, whether we're talking about what he said before or after the transfiguration, and that's not a choice because it's both, is concerning the coming kingdom, which he established at the resurrection. But that doesn't isolate it from the context of the transfiguration, of course. And we certainly are getting some insight into the life of the resurrection, which should be plainly obvious from the fact that we have two departed Old Testament saints standing there having a chat with Jesus in these glorified bodies.
But is it the future that we see here on this mountaintop? That's the real question.
That is the million-dollar question.
Sorry, Greg, we don't have $1 million for you.
Never mind, Greg. What about me? No? Okay. Now, if we're talking in terms of ordinary space and time as we know them, then we certainly can't be looking back in the past, because although Moses and Elijah both had mountaintop experiences with God, they were in different times and places in the past. But here's the thing, when you're in the presence of God, you're in the presence of the creator of space and time, who's independent of these things. So I just want to read you something from the Gospel of John, because although we're not getting the transfiguration from John, he also understands something of what goes on when you're in the presence of God. This is John 8, verses 56 to 58. "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad. The Jews then said to him, 'You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?' Jesus said to them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am.'" Now, this one's cool because we understand the idea of Jesus being one with the Father and therefore existing at the time of Abraham. But what we don't often spend time thinking about is that Abraham was able to see the incarnation of Christ. Now, we don't get told that in such explicit terms.
So where are we getting this idea from?
Oh, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but we'll do it again. This is Genesis 15, verses 4 to 6. "And behold, the word of the Lord came to Abraham, 'This man shall not be your heir. Your own son shall be your heir.' And he brought him outside and said, 'Look toward heaven and number the stars if you are able to number them.' Then he said to him, 'So shall your descendants be.' And he believed the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness." It's not apparent in English, but when the text has "look toward heaven," in Hebrew, that idea of looking toward is usually meant to be taken as looking down upon something. And that's not a novel understanding, because we actually have rabbinic tradition that preserves that interpretation. But we don't need the rabbis, because we're getting it from Jesus. The way Jesus understands this passage is that the word of the Lord, who was actually Jesus himself — remember that the Apostle John describes Jesus as the Word become flesh in chapter 1. And that is building on an early tradition of Judaism in which the Targumim rendered the embodied form of Yahweh as the Memra, the Word of God. He took Abraham in his dream vision, not just outside of his tent, but outside of creation. And the two of them observed heaven, as it were, under their feet. So what I want you to understand here is that when you're in the presence of the word of the Lord made flesh, you are in fact transcending both time and space. You find yourself in eternity. So whether we ask about the transfiguration as a glimpse into the future or the past, the answer is yes. Are we standing in the Garden of Eden or on Mount Sinai or in heaven or on Mount Hermon? Yes, this is what it's like to be in the presence of God.
And that is pretty mind-blowing.
So that extends to the question of whether this was the second coming being experienced on Mount Hermon, because it was the second coming that Jesus referred to. And what we need to understand is that the second coming doesn't happen in its fullness in a single moment, but is something that began at the resurrection, was made manifest in a greater sense at Pentecost, which continues to happen to this day in the hearts of the faithful, and which will be ultimately realized in its fullness when Jesus does in fact return bodily to the world. Now, I guess you could say that the saints who have died in the Lord are fortunate because they get to experience more of that reality at present, like what we saw with Moses and Elijah just now, while we who are alive remain. Rest assured that when we get there, we won't have missed anything. That's the great thing about eternity. That's why God is called the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. Those guys aren't dead, they're living, and the God of the living preserves them and us. So there you go, Greg. Hopefully that gives you some food for thought there and addresses that question to your satisfaction. Don't forget, listeners, you too can have your giant questions answered. By all means, send them in just like Greg. Go to the website, giantanswers.com, and fill out the form. You can be anonymous if you want to.
Yeah, that's right. And you can also find us on social media and post your questions there by reaching out through the Answers to Giant Questions Facebook page, the discussion group, or Tim's author page, TJ Stedman. And that's just Facebook. There's also Instagram and Threads and X, formerly known as Twitter. And while we're talking about online presence, don't forget that you can always visit Amazon or Goodreads and leave a review of the book there. And we've had some great reviews lately, so that's very appreciated because more reviews equals more exposure to a wider audience.
That's right. And yeah, I really do value those reviews. Not that it's about making me feel good, but it lets me know that I'm on the right track. And I should just mention that you can also leave feedback about the podcast. So if this show has been good for you, please let people know, because once again, it's how those algorithms work. And it's how you get this material in front of more people. So please, if you're getting anything out of this at all, please make sure you spread the word, even if it's just clicking on those 5 stars or sharing a few positive words. We don't ask you for money. We just ask for the opportunity to share God's word with as many people as possible. I do charge for my book, and I have ironically been criticized about that, despite the fact that I don't make any profit, because I use the money from those sales to keep the websites and everything up to date and active. You know, if I could get web hosting and that kind of stuff absolutely free and without making the whole thing full of adverts, I'd do that in a heartbeat, but unfortunately everything comes at a cost. So the book sales cover that cost for me, as well as the cost of printing the books, and that's what enables me to do the podcast without charge. So yeah, if you could leave us a review, that'd be great.
It would be great. Okay, well, it's time for us to get out of here. So we'll say goodbye and catch all you good folks next time.
Looking forward to it.
I'm going to come up with something witty, but it's too late for that.
Yeah.
The time for wittiness has passed. The time for sleepiness has approached.
It's time to wrap up today's episode. But if you want more, don't forget to get yourself a copy of Answers to Giant Questions. We're asking readers to please leave a review of the book on Amazon or Goodreads to help it become more visible in search results. Even if you just give it stars, that'll help. But a full review is certainly really appreciated. Please also leave a review of this podcast wherever you found us so that new listeners can find us here on the show. This podcast comes out every week, but you want to make sure you never miss an episode. So if you haven't already subscribed, do that now, and you'll get notified when each new episode drops. We'll catch you next time on the Answers to Giant Questions podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, a production of the Raven Creek Social Club. If you like what you heard today, please take a moment to rate or review the show. Music supplied under copyright by Grave Forsaken, graveforsaken.com. You can get the book Answers to Giant Questions by TJ Stedman on Amazon in paperback and Kindle format. Check out the other podcasts at ravencreeksc.com and go to giantanswers.com for more answers to giant questions. Read the blog and catch us on the socials. Don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. Send us your giant questions and stay tuned to this podcast to get answers. We'll see you next time. Until then, stay safe and God bless.
And I like to say, same bat time, same bat channel. I don't like that show.
Yeah.
Made a mockery of Batman.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it kind of gave him a popularity that he never had before that.
There you go.
But when people say, like, oh, Superman wears underpants when he's outside, or
na-na-na-na-na, bad man. I just want to poke them in the eye with a sharp stick.
I like making people search for these things.
Okay. As if you don't get them, give them enough homework already. You know, when people say the gift of singleness, I say, yep.
Yeah.
Sure is. And I open that gift every day.
There are reasons why I haven't bothered getting into video. Like, I actually do have a YouTube channel, and all it has is a single 1 minute promo for the book, which I believe still says the podcast is coming soon.
Website under construction or whatever. Yeah.
Here we are, three years of podcasting, and I'm sitting here in front of my MacBook with a gaming headset, and that's it.
Yeah, okay.
I have a crate full of my recording gear. I don't touch it.
Wow.
Yeah, it didn't really have much interesting going on this week. Aside from this morning when I listened back to the previous week's recording and realized that I had accidentally duplicated the outtakes on the final recording.
What do you mean?
I mean that the 5 minutes or so of waffling and rambling that I generally tack on to the end of the show happened twice.
Oh, so the same ramblings.
That was embarrassing.
Well, you know, if it was that good, it might be worth listening to again.
It was a pretty cool story.
I don't know if our ramblings and wafflings are interesting enough for people to listen to, but...
Well, that's why I like to put them at the end. I'm like, you know, people don't have to sit through all that before they get to the show. And if they don't want to hear it, they can just...